twins who were busily demolishing my sewing basket. The cold air outside was a relief after the hot, smoky confines of the kitchen, and Jemmy quieted a little, though he continued to squirm and whine. He rubbed his hot, damp face against my neck and gnawed ferociously on the cloth of my shawl, fussing and drooling. I paced slowly to and fro, patting him gently and humming Lily Bolero under my breath. I found the exercise soothing in spite of Jemmy's crankiness. There was only one of him, after all, and he couldn't talk. "You're a male, too," I said to him, pulling his woolen cap over the soft, bright down that feathered his skull. "As a sex, you have your defects, but I will say that catfighting isn't one of them." Fond as I was of individual women, Bree, Masali, Lizzie, and even Mrs. Bug, I had to admit that taken en masse, I found men much easier to deal with. Whether this was the fault of my rather unorthodox upbringing, I'd been raised largely by my Uncle Lam and his Persian manservant Firouz, my experiences in the war, or simply an aspect of my own unconventional personality, I found men soothingly logical and, with a few striking exceptions, pleasingly direct. I turned to look at the house. It stood serene amid the spruce and chestnut trees, elegantly proportioned, soundly built. A face showed at one of the windows. The face stuck out its tongue and pressed flat against the pane, crossing its eyes above squashed nose and cheeks. High-pitched feminine voices and the sound of banging came to me faintly through the cold, clean air. "Hmm," I said, reluctant as I was to leave home again so soon, and little as I liked the idea of Jamie being involved in armed conflicts of any kind, the thought of going off to live in the company of 20 or 30 unshaven, reeking men for a week or two had developed a certain undeniable attraction. If it meant sleeping on the ground, into each life some rain must fall, I told Jemmy with a sigh. But I suppose you're just learning that now, aren't you, poor thing? He said, and drew himself up into a ball to escape the pain of his emergent teeth, his knees digging painfully into my side. I settled him more comfortably on my hip and gave him an index finger to chew on. His gums were hard and knobbly. I could feel the tender spot where the new tooth was coming in, swollen and hot under the skin. A piercing shriek came from the house, followed by the sound of shouts and running feet. "You know," I said conversationally, "I think a bit of whiskey would be just the thing for that, don't you?" And withdrawing the finger, I touched Jemmy up against my shoulder. I ducked past the cross and into the shelter of the big red spruce, just in time, as the door of the house burst open and Mrs. Bug's penetrating voice rose like a trumpet on the chilly air. It was a long way to the whiskey clearing, but I didn't mind. It was blessedly quiet in the forest, and Jemmy, lulled by the movement, finally relaxed into a doze, limp and heavy as a little sandbag in my arms. So late in the year all the deciduous trees had lost their leaves. The trail was ankle-deep in a crackling carpet of brown and gold, and maple seeds whirled past on the wind, brushing my skirts with a whisper of wings. A raven flew past, high above. It gave an urgent, raucous cry, and the baby jerked in my arms. "Hush," I said, hugging him close. "It's nothing, lovey, just a bird." Still, I looked after the raven and listened for another. They were birds of portent, or so said Highland superstition. One raven was an omen of change, two were good fortune, three were ill. I tried to dismiss such notions from my mind, but Nyawene had told me the raven was my guide, my spirit animal, and I never saw the big black shadows pass overhead without a certain shiver up the spine. Jemmy stirred, gave a brief squawk, and fell back into silence. I patted him and resumed my climb, wondering, as I made my way slowly up the mountain, what animal might be his guide. "The animal spirit chose you," Nyawene told me, "not the other way around. You must pay careful attention to signs and portents, and wait for your animal to manifest itself to you. Ian's animal was the wolf. Jamie's the bear, or so the Tuscarora said. I had wondered at the time what one was supposed to do if chosen by something ignominious like a shrew or dung beetle, but was too polite to ask. Only one raven. I could still hear it, though it was out of sight, but no echoing cry came from the firs behind me. An omen of change. You could have saved yourself the trouble, I said to it under my breath so as not to wake the baby. Hardly as though I needed telling, is it? I climbed slowly, listening to the sigh of the wind and the deeper sound of my own breath. At this season, change was in the air itself, the sense of ripeness and death borne on the breeze, and the breath of winter in its chill. Still, the rhythms of the turning earth brought change that was expected, ordained. Body and mind met it with knowledge, and, on the whole, with peace. The changes coming were of a different order, and one calculated to disturb the soul. I glanced back at the house. From this height I could see only the corner of the roof and the drifting smoke from the chimney. "What do you think?" I said softly, Jemmy's head beneath my chin, round and warm in its knitted cap. "Will it be yours? Will you live here, and your children after you?" It would be a very different life, I thought, from the one he might have led. If Brianna had risked the stones to take him back, but she had not. And so the little boy's fate lay here. Had she thought of that, I wondered, that by staying she chose not only for herself, but him, chose war and ignorance, disease and danger, but had risked all that for the sake of his father, for Roger. I wasn't entirely sure it had been the right choice, but it hadn't been my choice to make. Still, I reflected, there was no way of imagining beforehand what having a child was like. No power of the mind was equal to the knowledge of just what the birth of a child could do, wresting lives and wrenching hearts. "And a good thing, too," I said to Jemmy. "No one in their right mind would do it otherwise." My sense of agitation had faded by now, soothed by the wind and the peace of the leafless wood. The whiskey clearing, as we called it, was hidden from the trail. Jamie had spent days searching the slopes above the ridge before finding a spot that met his requirements. Or spots, rather. The malting floor was built in a small clearing at the foot of a hollow. The still was farther up the mountain in a clearing of its own, near a small spring that provided fresh, clear water. The malting floor was out of direct sight of the trail, but not difficult to get to. "No point in hiding it," Jamie had said, explaining his choice to me, "when anyone we knows could walk to it blindfolded." True enough. Even now, when there was no grain actively fermenting in the shed or toasting on the floor, a faintly fecund, smoky scent lingered in the air. When grain was working, the musty, pungent scent of fermentation was perceptible at a distance. But when the sprouting barley was spread on the floor above a slow fire, a thin haze of smoke hung over the clearing, and the smell was strong enough to reach Fergus's cabin when the wind was right. No one was at the malting floor now, of course. When a new batch was working, either Massali or Fergus would be here to tend it, but for the moment the roofed floor lay empty, smooth boards darkened to grey by use and weather. There was a neat stack of firewood piled nearby, though, ready for use. I went close enough to see what sort of wood it was. Fergus liked hickory, both because it split more easily, and for the sweet taste it gave the malted grain. Jamie, deeply traditional in his approach to whisky, would use nothing but oak. I touched a chunk of split wood. Wide grain, light wood, thin bark. I smiled. Jamie had been here recently, then. Normally, a small keg of whisky was kept at the malting floor, both for the sake of hospitality and caution.
"If someone should come upon the lass alone there, best she have something to give them," Jamie had said. "It's known what we do there. Best no one should try to make Massali tell them where the brew is."
It wasn't the best whisky, generally a very young, raw spirit, but certainly good enough either for uninvited visitors or a teething child. "You haven't got any taste buds yet, anyway, so what's the odds?" I murmured to Jemmy, who stirred and smacked his lips in his sleep, screwing up his tiny face in a scowl. I hunted about, but there was no sign of the small whiskey keg, either in its usual place behind the bags of barley or inside the pile of firewood. Perhaps taken away for refilling. Perhaps stolen. No great matter in either case. I turned to the north, past the malting floor, took 10 steps, and turned right. The stone of the mountain jutted out here, a solid block of granite thrusting upward from the growth of tupelo and buttonbush. Only it wasn't solid. 2 slabs of stone leaned together, the open crack below them masked by holly bushes. I pulled my shawl over Jemmy's face to protect him from the sharp-edged leaves, and squeezed carefully behind them, ducking down to go through the cleft. The stone face fell away in a crumple of huge boulders on the far side of the cleft, with saplings and undergrowth sprouting willy-nilly in the crevices between the rocks. From below it looked impassable, but from above a faint trail was visible, threading down to another small clearing. Hardly a clearing, no more than a gap in the trees, where a clear spring bubbled from the rock and disappeared again into the earth. In summer it was invisible even from above, shielded by the leafy growth of the trees around it. Now, on the verge of winter, the white glimmer of the rock by the spring was easily visible through the leafless scrim of alder and mountain ash. Jamie had found a large pale boulder and rolled it to the head of the spring, where he had scratched the form of a cross upon it, and said a prayer consecrating the spring to our use. I had thought at the time of making a joke equating whisky with holy water, thinking of Father Kenneth and the baptisms, but had on second thoughts refrained. I wasn't so sure Jamie would think it a joke. I made my way cautiously down the slope, the faint trail leading through the boulders, and finally round an outcrop of rock before debouching into the spring clearing. I was warm from the walking, but it was cold enough to numb my fingers where I gripped the edges of my shawl. And Jamie was standing at the edge of the spring in nothing but his shirt. I stopped dead, hidden by a scrubby growth of evergreens. It wasn't his state of undress that haunted me, but rather something in the look of him. He looked tired, but that was only reasonable since he'd been up and gone so early. The ragged breeks he wore for riding lay puddled on the ground nearby, his belt and its impedimenta neatly coiled beside them. My eye caught a dark blotch of colour, half hidden in the grass beyond, the blue and brown cloth of his hunting kilt. As I watched, he pulled the shirt over his head and dropped it, then knelt down naked by the spring and splashed water over his arms and face. His clothes were mud-streaked from riding, but he wasn't filthy by any means. A simple hand and face wash would have sufficed, I thought, and could have been accomplished in much greater comfort by the kitchen hearth. He stood up, though, and taking the small bucket from the edge of the spring, scooped up cold water and poured it deliberately over himself, closing his eyes and gritting his teeth as it streamed down his chest and legs. I could see his balls draw up tight against his body, looking for shelter as the icy water sluiced through the auburn bush of his pubic hair and dripped off his cock. "Your grandfather has lost his bloody mind," I whispered to Jemmy, who stirred and grimaced in his sleep, but took no note of ancestral idiosyncrasies. I knew Jamie wasn't totally impervious to cold. I could see him gasp and shudder from where I stood in the shelter of the rock, and I shivered in sympathy. A Highlander, born and bred, he simply didn't regard cold, hunger, or general discomfort as anything to take account of. Even so, this seemed to be taking cleanliness to an extreme. He took a deep, gasping breath and poured water over himself a second time. When he bent to scoop up the third bucketful, it began to dawn on me what he was doing. A surgeon scrubs before operating for the sake of cleanliness, of course. But that isn't all there is to it. The ritual of soaping the hands, scrubbing the nails, rinsing the skin, repeated and repeated to the point of pain, is as much a mental activity as a physical one. The act of washing oneself in this obsessive way serves to focus the mind and prepare the spirit. One is washing away external preoccupation, sloughing petty distraction, just as surely as one scrubs away germs and dead skin. I had done it often enough to recognise this particular ritual when I saw it. Jamie wasn't merely washing. He was cleansing himself, using the cold water not only as solvent, but as mortification. He was preparing himself for something, and the notion made a small, cold trickle run down my own spine, chilly as the spring water. Sure enough, after the third bucketful, he set it down and shook himself, droplets flying from the wet ends of his hair into the dry grass like a spatter of rain. No more than half dry, he pulled the shirt back over his head and turned to the west, where the sun lay low between the mountains. He stood still for a moment, very still. The light streamed through the leafless trees, bright enough that from where I stood I could see him now only in silhouette, light glowing through the damp linen of his shirt, the darkness of his body a shadow within. He stood with his head lifted, shoulders up, a man listening. For what? I tried to still my own breathing and pressed the baby's capped head gently into my shoulder to keep him from waking. I listened too. I could hear the sound of the woods, a constant soft sigh of needle and branch. There was little wind, and I could hear the water of the spring nearby, a muted rush past stone and root. I heard quite clearly the beating of my own heart and Jemmy's breath against my neck. And suddenly I felt afraid, as though the sounds were too loud, as though they might draw the attention of something dangerous to us. I froze, not moving at all, trying not to breathe, and, like a rabbit under a bush, to become part of the wood around me. Jemmy's pulse beat blue, a tender vein across his temple, and I bent my head over him to hide it.
This ends Disc 11. The Fiery Cross, Disc 12.
Jamie said something aloud in Gaelic. It sounded like a challenge, or perhaps a greeting. The words seemed vaguely familiar, but there was no one there. The clearing was empty. The air felt suddenly colder, as though the light had dimmed. A cloud crossing the face of the sun, I thought, and looked up. But there were no clouds. The sky was clear. Jemmy moved suddenly in my arms, startled, and I clutched him tighter, willing him to make no sound. Then the air stirred, the cold faded, and my sense of apprehension passed. Jamie hadn't moved. Now the tension went out of him and his shoulders relaxed. He moved just a little, and the setting sun lit his shirt in a nimbus of gold and caught his hair in a blaze of sudden fire. He took his dirk from its discarded sheath and with no hesitation drew the edge across the fingertips of his right hand. I could see the thin dark line across his fingertips and bit my lips. He waited a moment for the blood to well up, then shook his hand with a sudden hard flick of the wrist so that droplets of blood flew from his fingers and struck the standing stone at the head of the pool. He laid the dirk beneath the stone and crossed himself with the blood-streaked fingers of his right hand. He knelt then, very slowly, and bowed his head over folded hands. I'd seen him pray now and then, of course, but always in public, or at least with the knowledge that I was there. Now he plainly thought himself alone, and to watch him kneeling so, stained with blood and his soul given over, made me feel that I had spied on an act more private than any intimacy of the body. I would have moved or spoken, and yet to interrupt seemed a sort of desecration. I kept silent, but found I was no longer a spectator. My own mind had turned to prayer unintended. O Lord, the words formed themselves in my mind without conscious thought, I commend to you the soul of your servant James. Help him, please. And dimly thought, but help him with what? Then he crossed himself and rose, and time started again, without my having noticed it had stopped. I was moving down the hillside toward him, grass brushing my skirt, with no memory of having taken the first step. I didn't recall his rising, but Jamie was walking toward me, not looking surprised, but his face filled with light at sight of us.
"Mukria," he said, softly, smiling, and bent to kiss me.
His beard stubble was rough and his skin still chilled, fresh with water.
"You'd better put your trousers on," I said. "You'll freeze."
"I'll do. Kimara hau, aura oi."
To my surprise, Jemmy was awake and drooling, eyes wide blue in a rose-leaf face, all hint of temper gone without a trace. He leaned, twisting to reach for Jamie, who lifted him gently from my arms and cradled him against a shoulder, pulling the woolly cap down snugly over his ears.
"We're starting a tooth," I told Jamie. He wasn't very comfortable, so I thought perhaps a bit of whiskey on his gums. There wasn't any in the house.
"Oh, aye, we can manage that, I think. There's a bit in my flask."
Carrying the baby to the spot where his clothes lay, he bent and rummaged one-handed, coming up with the dented pewter flask he carried on his belt. He sat on a rock, balancing Jemmy on his knee, and handed me the flask to open.
"I went to the mash house," I said, pulling the cork with a soft pop,
but the cask was gone.
"Aye, Fergus has it. Here, I'll do it. My hands are clean."
He held out his left index finger, and I dribbled a bit of the spirit onto it.
"What's Fergus doing with it?" I asked, settling myself on the rock beside him.
"Keeping it," he said, uninformatively.
He stuck the finger in Jemmy's mouth, gently rubbing at the swollen gum.
"Oh, there it is. Aye, that hurts a bit, doesn't it? Ouch!"
He reached down and gingerly disentangled Jemmy's fingers from their grip on the hairs of his chest.
"Speaking of that," I said, and reached out to take his right hand.
Shifting his other arm to keep hold of Jemmy, he let me take the hand and turn his fingers upward. It was a very shallow cut, just across the tips of the first three fingers, the fingers with which he had crossed himself. The blood had already clotted, but I dribbled a bit more of the whiskey over the cuts and cleaned the smears of blood from his palm with my handkerchief. He let me tend him in silence, but when I finished and looked up at him, he met my eyes with a faint smile.
"It's all right, Sassenach," he said.
"Is it?" I said.
I searched his face. He looked tired but tranquil. The slight frown I had seen between his brows for the last few days was gone. Whatever he was about, he had begun it.
"You saw then?"
he asked quietly, reading my own face.
"Yes. Is it... it's to do with the cross in the dooryard, is it?"
"Oh, in a way, I suppose."
"What's it for?"
I asked bluntly. He pursed his lips, rubbing gently at Jemmy's sore gum. At last he said,
"You never saw Dougal Mackenzie call the clan, did you?"
I was more than startled at this, but answered cautiously.
"No. I saw Colum do it once, at the oath-taking at Leoch."
He nodded, the memory of that long-ago night of torches deep in his eyes.
"Aye,"
he said softly.
"I mind that. Colum was chief, and the men would come when he summoned them, surely. But it was Dougal who led them to war."
He paused a moment, gathering his thoughts.
"There were raids now and again. That was a different thing, and often no more than a fancy that took Dougal or Rupert, maybe an urge born of drink or boredom, a small band out for the fun of it, as much for cattle or grain. But to gather the clan for war, all the fighting men, that was a rarer thing. I only saw it the once myself, but it's no a sight you would forget."
A cross of pinewood had been there when he woke one morning at the castle, surprising him as he crossed the courtyard. The inhabitants of Leoch were up and about their business as usual, but no one glanced at the cross or referred to it in any way. Even so, there were undercurrents of excitement running through the castle. The men stood here and there in knots, talking in undertones. But when he joined a group, the talk shifted at once to desultory conversation.
"I was Colum's nephew, I," but newly come to the castle, and they kent my sire and grandsire.
Jamie's paternal grandfather had been Simon, Lord Lovat, chief of the Frasers of Lovat, and no great friend of the Mackenzies of Leoch.
I couldn't tell what was afoot, but something was.
The hair on my arms prickled whenever I caught someone's eye. At last he'd made his way to the stable and found old Alec, Colum's master of horse. The old man had been fond of Ellen Mackenzie, and was kind to the son for his mother's sake, as well as his own.
"'Tis the fiery cross, lad," he told Jamie, tossing him a curry comb and jerking his head toward the stalls. "You'll not have seen it before."
"It was old," he'd said, one of the ways that had been followed for hundreds of years, no one quite knowing where it had started, who'd done it first, or why.
"When a Hieland chief will call his men to war," the old man had said, deftly running his gnarled hand through a knotted mane, "he has a cross made and sets it afire. It's put out at once, skin, we blood or we water, but it's still called the Fiery Cross, and it will be carried through the glens and corries, assigned to the men of the clan to fetch their weapons and come to the gathering place, prepared for battle."
"Aye," Jamie had said, feeling excitement hollow his belly. "And who do we fight, then? Where do we ride?" The old man's grizzled brow had crinkled in amused approval at that "we."
"You'll follow where your chieftain leads you, lad. But tonight it will be the Grants we go against."
"It was too," Jamie said, "though not that night. When darkness came, Dougal lit the cross and called the clan. He doused the burning wood with sheep's blood, and two men rode out of the courtyard with the fiery cross to take it through the mountains. 4 days later, there were 300 men in that courtyard, armed with swords, pistols and dirks. And at dawn, on the 5th day, we rode to make war on the Grants."
His finger was still in the baby's mouth, his eyes distant as he remembered.
"That was the first time I used my sword against another man," he said. "I mind it well."
"I expect you do," I murmured. Jemmy was beginning to squirm and fuss again. I reached across and lifted him into my own lap to check.
Sure enough, his clout was wet.
Luckily I had another tucked into my belt for convenience. I laid him out across my knee to change. "And so this cross in our dooryard," I said, delicately, eyes on my work, "to do with the militia, is it?" Jamie sighed, and I could see the shadows of memory moving behind his eyes.
"Aye," he said. "Once I could have called, and the men would come without question. Because they were mine. Men of my blood. Men of my land."
His eyes were hooded, looking out over the mountainside that rose up before us. I thought he didn't see the wooded heights of the Carolina wilderness, though. Rather, the scoured mountains and rocky crofts of Lallybroch. I laid my free hand on his wrist. The skin was cold, but I could feel the heat of him just below the surface, like a fever rising. "They came for you. But you came for them, Jamie. You came for them at Culloden. You took them there, and you brought them back."
Ironic, I thought, that the men who had come then to serve at his summons were, for the most part, still safe at home in Scotland. No part of the Highlands had been untouched by war, but Lallybroch and its people were, for the most part, still whole, because of Jamie.
"Aye, that's so."
He turned to look at me, and a rueful smile touched his face. His hand tightened on mine for a moment, then relaxed, and the line deepened again between his brows. He waved a hand toward the mountains around us.
"But these men, there's no debt of blood between them and me. They're not Frasers. I am not born either laird or chief to them. If they come to fight at my call, it will be of their own will."
"Well, that," I said dryly, "and Governor Tryon's."
He shook his head at that.
"Nay. Not that. Will the governor ken which men are here, or which ones come to meet his summons?"
He grimaced slightly.
"He kens me, and that will do nicely."
I had to admit the truth of this.
Tryon would neither know nor care whom Jamie brought, only that he appeared with a satisfactory number of men behind him, ready to do the governor's dirty work. I pondered that for a moment, patting Jemmy's bottom dry with the hem of my skirt. All I knew of the American Revolution were the things I'd heard at second hand from Brianna's schoolbooks. And I, of all people, knew just how great the gap could be between written history and the reality. Also, we'd lived in Boston, and the schoolbooks naturally reflected local history. The general impression one got from reading about Lexington and Concord and the like was that the militia involved every able-bodied man in the community, all of whom sprang into action at the first hint of alarm, eager to perform their civic duty. Perhaps they did. Perhaps not. But the Carolina backcountry wasn't Boston. Not by a long chalk. "Ready to ride and spread the alarm," I said, half under my breath, "to every Middlesex village and farm."
"What?"
Jamie's brows shot up.
"Where's Middlesex?"
"Well, you'd think it was halfway between male and female," I said. "But it's really just the area around Boston. Though, of course, that's named after the one in England."
"Yes," he said, looking bewildered. "Aye, if you say so, Sassenach, but..."
"Militia."
I lifted Jemmy, who was bucking and squirming like a landed fish, making noises of extreme protest at being forcibly diapered. He kicked me in the stomach. "Oh, give over, child, do!"
Jamie reached over and took the baby under the arms, hoisting him from my lap.
"Here, I'll have him. Does he need more whiskey?"
"I don't know, but at least he can't squawk if your finger's in his mouth."
I relinquished Jemmy with some relief, returning to my train of thought. "Boston's been settled for more than 100 years, even now," I said. "It has villages and farms, and the farms aren't all that far from the villages. People have been living there for a long time. Everyone knows each other." Jamie was nodding patiently at each of these startling revelations, trusting that I would eventually come to some point. Which I did, only to discover that it was the same point he'd been making to me.
"So when someone musters militia there," I said, suddenly seeing what he'd been telling me all along,
"they come, because they're accustomed to fighting together to defend their towns, and because no man would want to be thought a coward by his neighbours. But here..." I bit my lip, contemplating the soaring mountains all around us.
"Aye," he said, nodding, seeing the realisation dawn in my face. "It's different here."
There was no settlement large enough to be called a town within 100 miles, save the German Lutherans at Salem. Bar that, there was nothing in the back country but scattered homesteads. Sometimes a place where a family had settled and spread, brothers or cousins building houses within sight of one another. Small settlements and distant cabins, some hidden in the mountain hollows, screened by laurels, where the residents might not see another white face for months or years at a time. The sun had sunk below the angled slope of the mountain, but the light still lingered, a brief wash of colour that stained the trees and rocks gold around us and flushed the distant peaks with blue and violet. There were living creatures in that cold, brilliant landscape, I knew, habitations nearby and warm bodies stirring. But so far as the eye could see, nothing moved. Mountain settlers would go without question to help a neighbour, because they might as easily require such help themselves at any moment. There was, after all, no one else to turn to. But they never fought for a common purpose, had nothing in common to defend. And to abandon their homesteads and leave their families without defence in order to serve the whim of a distant governor? A vague notion of duty might compel a few. A few would go from curiosity, from restlessness, or in the vague hope of gain. But most would go only if they were called by a man they respected, a man that they trusted. "I'm not born neither laird or chief to them," he'd said. "Not born to them, no. But born to it, nonetheless." He could, if he wished, make himself chief.
"Why?" I asked. "Why will you do it?"
The shadows were rising from the rocks, slowly drowning the light.
Do you not see?
One eyebrow lifted as he turned his head to me.
You told me what would happen at Culloden, and I believed you, Sassenach, fearful as it was. The men of Lallybroch came home safe as much because of you as because of me.
That was not entirely true. Any man who had marched to Nairn with the Highland army would have known that disaster lay somewhere ahead. Still, I had been able to help in some small way, to make sure that Lallybroch was prepared not only for the battle, but its aftermath. The small weight of guilt that I always felt when I thought of the rising lifted slightly, easing my heart.
Well, perhaps, but what? You've told me what will happen here, Sassenach. You and Brianna and Mackenzie, all three. Rebellion and war. And this time, victory.
Victory. I nodded numbly, remembering what I knew of wars and the cost of victory. It was, however, better than defeat.
Well then.
He stooped to pick up his dirk and gestured with it to the mountains around us.
I have sworn an oath to the crown. If I break it in time of war, I am a traitor. My land is forfeit, and my life. And those who follow me will share my fate. True.
True. I swallowed, hugging my arms tight around me, wishing I still held Jemmy. Jamie turned to face me, his eyes hard and bright.
But the crown will not prevail this time. You've told me. And if the king is overthrown, what then of my oath? If I've kept it, then I am traitor to the rebel cause.
Oh, I said, rather faintly.
You see? At some point, Tryon and the king will lose their power over me. But I dinna ken when that may be. At some point, the rebels will hold power. But I dinna ken when that may be. And in between?
He tilted the point of his dirk downward.
I do see. A very tidy little cleft stick, I said, feeling somewhat hollow as I realised just how precarious our situation was.
To follow Tryon's orders now was plainly the only choice. Later, however, for Jamie to continue as the governor's man into the early stages of the revolution was to declare himself a loyalist, which would be fatal in the long run. In the short run, though, to break with Tryon, forswear his oath to the king, and declare for the rebels, that would cost him his land and quite possibly his life. He shrugged, with a wry twist of the mouth, and sat back a little, easing Jemmy on his lap.
Well, it's no as though I've never found myself walking between two fires before, Sassenach. I may come out of it a bit scorched round the edges, but I dinna think I'll fry.
He gave a faint snort of what might be amusement.
It's in my blood, no?
I managed a short laugh.
If you're thinking of your grandfather, I said, I admit he was good at it. Caught up with him in the end, though, didn't it?
He tilted his head from one side to the other, equivocating.
Aye, maybe so. But do you not think things perhaps fell out as he wished?
The late Lord Lovett had been notorious for the deviousness of his mind, but I couldn't quite see the benefit in planning to have his head chopped off, and said so. Jamie smiled, despite the seriousness of the discussion.
Well, perhaps beheading wasn't quite what he'd planned, but still, you saw what he did. He sent young Simon to battle, and he stayed home. But which of them was it who paid the price on Tower Hill?
I nodded slowly, beginning to see his point. Young Simon, who was in fact close to Jamie's own age, hadn't suffered physically for his part in the rising, overt though it had been. He hadn't been imprisoned or exiled, like many of the Jacobites, and while he had lost most of his lands, he had in fact regained quite a bit of his property since, by means of repeated and tenacious lawsuits brought against the crown.
And old Simon could have blamed his son, and young Simon would have ended up on the scaffold. But he didn't.
Well, I suppose even an old viper like that might hesitate to put his own son and heir under the axe.
Jamie nodded.
Would you let someone chop off your head, Sassenach, if it was a choice between you and Brianna?
Yes, I said without hesitation. I was reluctant to admit that old Simon might have possessed such a virtue as family feeling, but I supposed even vipers had some concern for their children's welfare.
Jemmy had abandoned the proffered finger in favour of his grandfather's dirk and was gnawing fiercely on the hilt.
Jamie wrapped his hand around the blade, holding it safely away from the child, but made no effort to take the knife away.
"So would I," Jamie said, smiling slightly, "though I do hope it will not come to that."
"I don't think either army was, will be, inclined to behead people," I said. That did, of course, leave a number of other unpleasant options available, but Jamie knew that as well as I did. I had a sudden passionate wish to urge him to throw it all up, turn away from it, tell Tryon to stuff his land, tell the tenants they must make their own way, abandon the ridge and flee. War was coming, but it needn't engulf us, not this time. We could go south, to Florida, or to the Indies, to the west, to take refuge with the Cherokee, or even back to Scotland. The colonies would rise, but there were places one could run to.
He was watching my face.
"This," he said, a gesture dismissing Tryon, the militia, the regulators. "This is a very little thing, Sassenach. Perhaps nothing in itself. But it is the beginning, I think."
The light was beginning to fail now. The shadow covered his feet and legs, but the last of the sun threw his own face into strong relief. There was a smudge of blood on his forehead where he had touched it, crossing himself. I should have wiped it away, I thought, but made no move to do so.
"If I will save these men, if they will walk with me between the fires, then they must follow me without question, Sassenach. Best it begins now, while not so much is at stake."
"I know," I said, and shivered.
"Are you cold, Sassenach? Here, take the wain and go home. I'll come in a bit, so soon as I'm dressed."
He handed me Jemmy and the dirk, since the two seemed momentarily inseparable, and rose. He picked up his kilt and shook out the tartan folds, but I didn't move. The blade of the knife was warm where I gripped it, warm from his hand. He looked at me in question, but I shook my head. "We'll wait for you." He dressed quickly, but carefully. Despite my apprehensions, I had to admire the delicacy of his instincts. Not his dress kilt, the one in crimson and black, but the hunting kilt. No effort to impress the mountain men with richness, but an oddity of dress enough to make the point to the other Highlanders that he was one of them, to draw the eye and interest of the Germans. Plaid pinned up with a running stag brooch, his belt and scabbard, clean wool stockings. He was quiet, absorbed in what he was doing, dressing with a calm precision that was unnervingly reminiscent of the robing of a priest. It would be tonight, then. Roger and the rest had clearly gone to summon the men who lived within a day's ride. Tonight he would light his cross and call the first of his men, and seal the bargain with whiskey. "So, Bree was right," I said, to break the silence in the clearing. "She said perhaps you were starting your own religion. When she saw the cross, I mean." He glanced at me, startled. He looked in the direction where the house lay, then his mouth curled wryly.
"I suppose I am," he said. "God help me."
He took the knife gently away from Jemmy, wiped it on a fold of his plaid, and slid it away into its scabbard. He was finished. I stood to follow him. The words I couldn't speak, wouldn't speak, were a ball of eels in my throat. Afraid one would slither free and slip out of my mouth, I said instead, "Was it God you were calling on to help you, when I saw you earlier?"
"Och, no," he said.
He looked away for a second, then met my eyes with a sudden queer glance.
"I was calling Dougal Mackenzie."
I felt a deep and sudden qualm go through me. Dougal was long dead. He had died in Jamie's arms on the eve of Culloden. died with Jamie's dirk in his throat. I swallowed, and my eyes flickered involuntarily to the knife at his belt.
I made my peace with Dougal long ago, he said softly, seeing the direction of my glance.
He touched the hilt of the knife with its knurl of gold that had once been Hector Cameron's.
He was a chieftain, Dougal. He will know that I did then as I must, for my men, for you, and that I will do it now again.
I realized now what it was he had said, standing tall, facing the west, the direction to which the souls of the dead fly home. It had been neither prayer nor plea. I knew the words, though it was many years since I had heard them. He had shouted,
Tullochast,
the war cry of Clan Mackenzie. I swallowed hard.
And will he help you, do you think?
He nodded, serious.
If he can, he said. We will have fought together many times, Dougal and I, hand to hand and back to back. And after all, Sassenach, blood is blood.
I nodded back mechanically and lifted Jemmy up against my shoulder. The sky had bleached to a winter white, and shadow filled the clearing. The stone at the head of the spring stood out, a pale and ghostly shape above black water.
Let's go, I said.
It's nearly night. Chapter 23 The Bard. It was full dark when Roger finally reached his own door, but the windows glowed welcomingly, and sparks showered from the chimney, promising warmth and food. He was tired, chilled, and very hungry, and he felt a deep and thankful appreciation for his home, substantially sharpened by the knowledge that he would leave it on the morrow.
Brianna?
He stepped inside, squinting in the dim glow, looking for his wife.
There you are. You're so late. Where have you been?
She popped out of the small back room, the baby balanced on her hip, and a heap of tartan cloth clutched to her chest. She leaned over it to kiss him briefly, leaving him with a tantalizing taste of plum jam.
I've been riding uphill and down Deal for the last 10 hours, he said, taking the cloth from her and tossing it onto the bed. Looking for a mythical family of Dutchmen. Come here and kiss me properly, aye?
She obligingly wrapped her free arm round his waist and gave him a lingering plum-scented kiss that made him think that, hungry as he was, dinner could perhaps wait for a bit. The baby, however, had other ideas, and set up a loud wail that made Brianna hastily detach herself, grimacing at the racket.
"Still teething," Roger said,
observing his offspring's red and swollen countenance, covered with a shiny coating of snot, saliva, and tears.
"How did you guess?" she said caustically. "Here, can you take him just for a minute?"
She thrust Jemmy, writhing, into his father's arms, and tugged at her bodice, the green linen damply creased and stained with pale splotches of spit-up milk. One of her breasts bobbed into view, and she reached out for Jemmy, sitting down with him in the nursing chair by the fire.
"He's been fussing all day," she said, shaking her head as the baby squirmed and whined, batting at the proffered nourishment with a fretful hand. "He won't nurse for more than a few minutes, and when he does, he spits it up again. He whines when you pick him up, but he screams if you set him down."
She shoved a hand tiredly through her hair. "I feel like I've been wrestling alligators all day."
"Oh, that's too bad."
Roger rubbed his aching lower back, trying not to be ostentatious about it. He pointed toward the bed with his chin.
What's the tartan for?"
"Oh, I forgot. That's yours."
Attention momentarily distracted from the struggling child, she glanced up at Roger, taking in for the first time his dishevelled appearance.
"Da brought it down for you to wear tonight. You have a big smudge of mud on your face, by the way. Did you fall off?"
"Several times."
He moved to the washstand, limping only slightly. One sleeve of his coat and the knee of his breeches were plastered with mud, and he rubbed at his chest, trying to dislodge bits of dry leaf that had got down the neck of his shirt.
"Oh? That's too bad."
"Shh, shh, shush," she crooned to the child, rocking him to and fro.
"Did you hurt yourself?
Oh, no, it's fine.
He shed the coat and turned his back, pouring water from the pitcher into the bowl. He splashed cold water over his face, listening to Jemmy's squeals, and privately calculating the odds of being able to make love to Brianna sometime before having to leave next morning. Between Jemmy's teeth and his grandfather's plans, the chances seemed slight, but hope sprang eternal. He blotted his face with a towel, glancing covertly around in hopes of food. Both table and hearth were empty, though there was a strong vinegar scent in the air.
Sauerkraut, he guessed, sniffing audibly. The Mueller's.
They bought two big jars of it, Brianna said, gesturing toward the corner where a stone crock stood in its shadows. That one's ours. Did you get anything to eat while you were out?
No.
His belly rumbled loudly, evidently willing to consider cold sauerkraut, if that was all that was on offer. Presumably there would be food at the big house, though. Cheered by this thought, he pulled off his breeches and began the awkward business of pleating up the tartan cloth to make a belted plaid. Jemmy had quieted a little, now making no more than intermittent yips of discomfort as his mother rocked him to and fro.
"What was that about mythical Dutchman?" Brianna asked, still rocking, but now with a moment's attention to spare.
"Jamie sent me up to the northeast to look for a family of Dutchmen he'd heard had settled near Boiling Creek, to tell the men about the militia summons, and have them come back with me if they would."
He frowned at the cloth laid out on the bed. He'd worn a plaid like this only twice before, and both times had had help to put the thing on.
"Is it important for me to wear this, do you think?"
Brianna snorted behind him with brief amusement. "I think you'd better wear something. You can't go up to the big house in nothing but your shirt."
"You couldn't find the Dutchman, then?"
"Not so much as a wooden shoe."
He had found what he thought was Boiling Creek, and had ridden up the bank for miles, dodging, or not, overhanging branches, bramble patches, and thickets of witch hazel, but hadn't found a sign of anything larger than a fox that had slipped across his path, disappearing into the brush like a flame suddenly extinguished.
"Maybe they moved on, went up to Virginia or Pennsylvania," Brianna spoke with sympathy.
It had been a long, exhausting day, with failure at the end of it.
Not a terrible failure. Jamie had said only, "Find them if you can."
And if he had found them, they might not have understood his rudimentary Dutch, gained on brief holidays to the Amsterdam of the 1960s. Or might not have come in any case. Still, the small failure nagged at him like a stone in his shoe. He glanced at Brianna, who grinned widely at him in anticipation.
"All right," he said with resignation. "Laugh if you must."
Getting into a belted plaid wasn't the most dignified thing a man could do, given that the most efficient method was to lie down on the pleated fabric and roll like a sausage on a girdle. Jamie could do it standing up, but then the man had had practice. His struggles, rather deliberately exaggerated, were rewarded by Brianna's giggling, which in turn seemed to have a calming effect on the baby. By the time Roger made the final adjustments to his pleats and drapes, mother and child were both flushed but happy. Roger made a leg to them, flourishing, and Bree patted her own leg in one-handed applause.
"Terrific," she said, her eyes travelling appreciatively over him. "See, Daddy? Pretty Daddy."
She turned Jimmy, who stared open-mouthed at the vision of male glory before him, and blossomed into a wide, slow smile, a trickle of drool hanging from the pouting curve of his lip. Roger was still hungry, sore, and tired, but it didn't seem so important. He grinned and held out his arms toward the baby.
"Do you need to change? If he's full and dry, I'll take him up to the house. Give you a bit of time to fix up."
"You think I need fixing up, do you?"
Brianna gave him an austere look down her long, straight nose. Her hair had come down in wisps and straggles. Her dress looked as though she'd been sleeping in it for weeks, and there was a dark smear of jam on the upper curve of one breast.
"You look great," he said, bending and swinging Jemmy deftly up.
Hush, Shavalach. You've had enough of Mummy, and she's definitely had enough of you for a bit. Come along with me.
Don't forget your guitar, Bree called after him as he headed for the door. He glanced back at her, surprised.
What?
Dar wants you to sing. Wait, he gave me a list.
A list? Of what?
To the best of Roger's knowledge, Jamie Fraser paid no attention whatever to music. It rankled him a bit, in fact, though he seldom admitted it, that his own greatest skill was one that Fraser didn't value.
Songs, of course.
She furrowed her brow, conjuring up the memorized list.
He wants you to do Ho Ro and Bernie Boozle and The Great Silky. You can do other stuff in between, he said, but he wants those, and then get into the warmongering stuff. That's not what he called it, but you know what I mean. Killiecrankie and the Whores of Cromdale and the Sheriffsmuir fight. Just the older stuff, though. He says, don't do the songs from the 45 except for Johnny Cope. He wants that one for sure, but toward the end, and...
Roger stared at her, disentangling Jemmy's foot from the folds of his plaid.
I wouldn't have thought your father so much as knew the names of songs, let alone had preferences.
Brianna had stood up and was reaching for the long wooden pin that held her hair in place. She pulled it out and let the thick red shimmer cascade over shoulders and face. She ran both hands through the ruddy mass and pushed it back, shaking her head.
He doesn't have preferences, I mean. Da's completely tone-deaf. Mama says he has a good sense of rhythm, but he can't tell one note from another.
That's what I thought. But why? He may not listen to music, Roger, but he listens. She glanced at him, snigging the comb through the tangles of her hair. And he watches.
He knows how people act and how they feel when they hear you do those songs.
Does he? Roger murmured. He felt an odd spark of pleasure at the thought that Fraser had indeed noticed the effect of his music, even if he didn't appreciate it personally.
So, he means me to soften them up, is that it? Get them in the mood before he goes on for his own bit?
That's it. She nodded, busy untying the laces of her bodice. Escaped from confinement, her breasts bobbed suddenly free, round and loose under the thin muslin shift. Roger shifted his weight, easing the fit of his plaid. She caught the slight movement and looked at him. Slowly she drew her hands up, cupping her breasts and lifting them, her eyes on his and a slight smile on her lips. Just for a moment he felt as though he had stopped breathing, though his chest continued to rise and fall. She was the first to break the moment, dropping her hands and turning to delve into the chest where she kept her linen.
"Do you know exactly what he's up to?"
she asked, her voice muffled in the depths of the chest.
"Did he have that cross up when you left?"
"Aye, I know about it."
Jemmy was making small huffing noises, like a toy engine struggling up a hill. Roger tucked him under one arm, his hand cradling the fat little belly.
"It's a fiery cross. Do you ken what that is?"
She emerged from the chest, a fresh shift in her hands, looking mildly disturbed.
"A fiery cross? You mean he's going to burn a cross in the yard?" "Well, not burn it all the way, no."
Taking down his bothron with his free hand and flicking a finger against the drum head to check the tautness, he explained briefly the tradition of the fiery cross.
"It's a rare thing," he concluded, moving the drum out of Jemmy's grasping reach. "I don't think it was ever done in the Highlands again after the Rising. Your father told me he'd seen it once, though. It's something really special to see it done here."
Flushed with historical enthusiasm, he didn't notice at once that Brianna seemed slightly less eager.
"Maybe so," she said uneasily. "I don't know. It sort of gives me the creeps."
"Eh?"
Roger glanced at her in surprise.
"Why?"
She shrugged, pulling the crumpled shift off over her head.
"I don't know. Maybe it's just that I have seen burning crosses on the evening news on TV. You know, the KKK. Or do you know? Maybe they didn't report things like that on television in Britain.
The Ku Klux Klan."
Roger was less interested in fanatical bigots